Good day, and welcome to the Cigna Drug and Alcohol Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. Now, at this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Ms. Amy Papageorge. Please go ahead.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for Cigna's Drug and Alcohol Awareness Series. My name is Amy Papageorge, and I'm a therapist and care manager for the Outpatient Substance Abuse Team at Cigna. Due to the format of this seminar, you will not be able to ask questions during the talk, but there will be an opportunity to ask questions at the end. Following today's presentation, you will be asked to participate in a brief five-question survey so that we can get your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After the survey, you will be able to ask our speaker questions regarding his talk. Please limit your questions to the seminar topic. If you have specific questions regarding substance abuse treatment or your policy, please contact the outpatient team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. There is a PowerPoint for today's seminar available online. To access the PowerPoint, go to www.cigna.com/substance abuse and then click on today's presentation. Again, that's www.cigna.com/substance abuse and then click on today's presentation. Today I have the pleasure of introducing John Diben. John is certified as both a mental health professional and addictions professional and is the director of spiritual care and wellness for the Hanley Center in Florida. He has many years' experience working as a pastor and counselor in a diverse range of environments. John?
Thank you so much. So, good afternoon, everybody. Today we want to talk about an incredibly important aspect of chemical dependency and addiction that we don't often talk too much about in society, and it's how addiction affects the family. I'm going to walk through the PowerPoint presentation, and so I encourage you, if you have it, to walk through it with me, and if you haven't, to bring it up, because it's going to be helpful for following along. The first thing we want to talk about today is what is addiction? We want to begin with having a quick overview of what addiction is. Then we want to talk about how all of us have some sort of relationship with mood-altering substances and how that impacts our lives. But then we want to spend the rest of the time really talking about how addiction affects the family. So we're going to understand what addiction is, how all of us are impacted by substance use and abuse to some degree. And then we really want to talk about what is a family and how are family systems affected by addiction. So let's go to our first slide that says simply, what is addiction? When we, you know, when you think about that word, it's funny, I get to work with people from very young, you know, 18, 19, 20-year-olds who are suffering from addiction to much older adults. I work with 70 and 80-year-old adults in geriatric substance abuse. And I find that the word addiction or addict or alcoholic, these words carry different meanings for different people. Certainly some people, when they hear the word addict or alcoholic, think about a moral failure or a weakness. Well, the National Institute on Drug Abuse in 2012 came out with a very concise and an important definition of addiction, and that's what we're going to use today. NIDA says that addiction is a chronic, often relapsing brain disease that causes compulsive drug seeking and use. And that word compulsive, we're going to come back to that. So if you're, you know, kind of highlight or underline that, it causes compulsive drug seeking and use despite harmful consequences to the addicted individual and to those around him or her. Simply put, addiction is when a person feels like they must continue to use drugs and alcohol even when that use causes problems in their lives. And all of us have some relationship with mood-altering substances. On our next slide, I list kind of the four relationships that we have. For some people, the relationship they have with mood-altering substances, and I'm talking about everything from hard drugs, you know, like heroin or cocaine that we would think of, to alcohol, to marijuana, and even to some prescription medications that can sometimes be very addictive. with all of those things, we all have one of four relationships. Some people have the relationships of abstinence with mood-altering substances. They say, I don't use drugs or alcohol, I don't smoke, I stay away from those things. That's abstinence. Some people, their relationship with mood-altering substances is use. They might say, I have a glass of wine with dinner, or they might say, if I'm prescribed pain meds that might be potentially addictive, but the doctor prescribes them, I use them, I don't have any problem with that. But these people, the use of mood-altering substances, including alcohol, doesn't cause problems in their lives, and if it does, they stop. Then there are people who fall into the abuse category. And these are people who use mood-altering substances. And again, alcohol is a really good example because it's a drug like other drugs, but it's a good example because it's the most common that we see in our culture. But these people, they might say, I use mood-altering substances like alcohol, but it begins to cause problems in their lives, and they continue to use anyway. So someone might say, I know that I'm drinking too much and I got a DUI, but I'm still going to drink anyway. Or I've got a medical condition like diabetes that's made worse by drinking or using, but I continue to use anyway. That's substance abuse. Finally, the most serious category is when people are substance dependent. And this is where we talk about addiction, alcoholism, chemical dependency. And these people meet all that criteria for substance abuse so that they use mood-altering substances even though it causes problems in their lives. But they have a really important additional component, and it's called compulsivity. Compulsivity means that even if they decide they want to stop, there is something in their brain that tells them they have to keep using. And if you look at the next slide, you'll see that when a person experiences substance dependence, and we're going to talk more about this in just a minute, but it affects everything. It affects them physically. It affects them psychologically. It affects them spiritually. It affects them in their social and family and community areas. So let's think about this. Think about substance dependence. So a person is drinking alcohol. It is causing severe problems in their lives, but there is something in their brain that tells them that they can't stop, that they have to keep using, and in fact, it becomes more and more and more important to them. Well, physically, it's going to affect, the way their body functions. It's going to affect their blood sugar. It's going to affect their liver. We're all familiar with these things. Psychologically, it's going to decrease their ability to cope with normal problems in everyday life. Spiritually, people become disconnected from all of life. And then what we're really here to focus on today is how it affects the family, that community, that social. People start to see their friends less. They start having problems at work. And their family members even see them drifting away from them. If you look at the next slide that says the problem, the best illustration is you see this kind of bullseye on the page. And I want you to imagine for yourself, put for yourself in the center, what is the most important thing in your life, and put it in that center dot. So someone might say my family. For most of us, probably on this earth, the most important thing to us is our immediate family. So then right outside of that, what's next? Someone might say, well, my immediate family is in the very center circle. How about my extended family is in that next outer circle? And then in the next outer circle, my friends, my good, close friends. And then in the next outer circle, perhaps my work friends and my acquaintances. For some people, it might be my religious group or a social group that I'm involved with. What happens in addiction is that from the outside in, when a person is dependent on a substance, the circles from the outside in become less and less important than the substance. So if I am alcoholic, that outside circle of perhaps my social organizations, perhaps even my job, that becomes less and less important, and it's going to get neglected. It may even fall away. And then after that does, my next circle, perhaps my close friends, I stop calling them as much. I especially stay away from them if they're saying to me, hey, that you got a problem. And so eventually that circle kind of goes away. And that continues to happen. Addiction erodes all of the levels of important relationships until it even erodes the entire importance of the relationships in that center. And what happens in chemical dependence is that the drug becomes what's in the center. And this is not simply a matter of willpower. There is a disease that affects the brain that causes the symptom of compulsivity, and it only gets worse and worse and worse. So people who truly have addiction have a compromised brain, to put it simply. And the result is that their relationships and what's important to them erode. Recently, I was talking to a family. Actually, I was talking to a group of therapists, and I was talking about what happens to the brain when we are addicted. And the part of the brain where we make good choices, that part of the brain where our moral centers are. When a person is truly chemically dependent, that part of the brain is not working as well as it should be. And so because of active addiction, people have a decreased ability to make good decisions. Well, after the talk, one woman came up to me and she said, my kids are all adults now. They're grown. And when they were still teenagers, their father died of alcoholism. And they've wondered for 10 years how their dad could have chosen the bottle over them. Because he loved them, and yet as the alcoholism progressed, he chose it looked like he was choosing the bottle over his kids. Well, the reality is that the disease of addiction takes away, to some degree, it decreases a person's ability to make healthy choices. And this is why it is so imperative to stop the process of addiction and to engage recovery as soon as possible. So what then does that have to do with the family beyond, well, the family just kind of becomes a victim, in essence, of the disease? Well, there's actually a lot more to it. On the next slide that's labeled family systems, I want to start stepping back and thinking about what a family is. Now, traditionally, families have been seen by many people as a group of more or less independent agents linked by their membership in the family. A lot of times people will think of families as sort of like the food court in the mall. It's one food court, but they're really all independent little restaurants. And some will do really well, and that's good for them, and some will fail, and that's too bad for them, but they're really just independent agents living together in the same area. And the idea is that any given member's behavior was not necessarily related to the behavior of any other family member. So if the Chinese restaurant succeeds and the Italian restaurant fails, well, that's just the way it is. They're not related to each other. So if we think of families like that, which traditionally I think a lot of times we have, it's entirely likely that a parent might come and say something like this. A parent might say, I have two children. My daughter is terrific, but my son is always in trouble. Since I raised them both the same way, there must be something dreadfully wrong with my son. Now, my guess is that, and I can't see those that are listening, but my guess is that there are some people who are nodding their heads, or people who relate to that in one way or another. Well, when we think about family systems, we think about it very, very differently. In fact, we think about it not like restaurants in a food court, but more like the pieces of an engine in your car. On our next slide, there's a great definition by a marriage and family therapist, Dan Smith, and he says this. By definition, a family system functions because it is a unit, and every family member plays a critical, if not unique, role in the system. Here's the really, really important thing. As such, it is not possible that one member of a system can change without causing a ripple effect of change throughout the family system. So I'll give you an example before we go to the case study, and I've seen this happen. So you have a family, even before you have a family, you know, Jack and Jill meet in college and they fall madly in love. And they graduate college and they get jobs and start lives and they get married. Then they have two kids. They both drink, but Jack, as they progress in the marriage, Jack starts drinking more and more. Well, it turns out that Jack has a genetic predisposition for alcoholism. Of course, they didn't know that, but Jack actually becomes alcoholic. And where Jane at some point sets down alcohol, Jack can't, and he keeps drinking and drinking and drinking. So as they go on in their marriage, because they are close and they're in love and they're completely connected, Jack begins to drink so much that his work begins to suffer. He begins to drink till late at night and have hangovers, and so Jane doesn't want him to lose his job, and so she begins to call in and say, you know, Jack's feeling sick today, and she begins to cover for Jack and then kind of take care of him. And then even the kids, as they get older, they begin to get used to this, and even the kids begin to help Dad out and cover for him and learn how to take care of themselves, and they kind of make the rules for themselves because Mom's too busy taking care of Dad, and Dad's just his alcoholism is out of control. So eventually at some point, after many fights and after the Jane saying, Jack, you've got to stop drinking, I can't keep doing this, Jack goes to treatment. Jack goes to treatment, and he really wants to stop drinking. And so he begins to, you know, he throws himself into the process of treatment. He's in residential treatment for 60 days, and then he does well there, and he's excited, and he comes home, and he's not drinking anymore, and the family is excited, Jane's excited, the kids are excited, and he begins to come home, and they start their lives again, and he begins to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's doing well. And everybody's excited that Jack isn't drinking anymore. And then, somewhere in a month or two, Jane says to Jack, you know, Jack, I think maybe you should just have a drink. Now, when I say that story and I mention that, it can sound to some people like, why in the world would she do such a thing? But the reality is, all of us are looking for homeostasis. And we're going to talk about homeostasis in a minute, but it's important to recognize that even when one member of the family system goes from being unhealthy to healthy, it still is a big change in the family system. So family systems are always affected by any change in the system. We're going to come back to this point. Let's look at our case study. So, just thinking about kids. Now we're just talking about kids. We're not even talking about addiction. Melissa is a straight-A student. She gets a great deal of parental attention for her success in school. She comes home with great grades, and they make a big deal out of it. Now, Jason, Melissa's little brother, he struggles. He works hard. He does his best, but he's not a straight-A student. He's a straight-B student. And when he comes in and he hands in his straight-Bs, he doesn't get that praise that Melissa gets. He gets comments like, you know what? Just study a little bit more. Just try a little bit better, and you'll be as good as Melissa. Soon enough, he's going to realize that he can become, that he's not going to get his parents' attention through his academics. But he realizes he can get their attention if he starts to act out, if he starts to fail, if he starts engaging in delinquent behavior. So, how would that be traditionally handled in a therapy session? Well, the family would come to the therapist and say, Jason is acting out. He is the identified patient. He's the problem. He's the one that's in the principal's office, and we have to do something. And the therapist would be told, you need to fix Jason. But when we look at it from a family systems view, we realize that the whole family is the patient. And that for Jason to have a change in his life and his outlook and his behavior, the whole family system has to change. And so if we look at it from a systems perspective, then we realize it's not just one person in the system who is ever, quote, the problem. Rather, our whole family needs help. When it comes to addiction, when it comes to chemical dependency, it's imperative that we recognize that it is not only the chemically dependent person that needs help, but the entire family system. As we go to the next slide, we come to this word homeostasis, family homeostasis. It's a big word, but here's what it means. Homeostasis means that things feel normal. It's that simple. Think about it. I recently was at an event where professionals were seated around tables, and it was a weekend seminar. And there were no assigned seats, but you can imagine that when, and I think all of us can relate to this, so almost all of us, including me, I went to a seat when I first got there. I just took it for whatever reason. It happened to be empty. And then at different times over the weekend, we would go out on break. Well, when we came back from break, where did I sit? I sat in the exact same spot. And the next day, when we came back from having the night off, where did I sit? In the exact same spot. In fact, all of us sat in the exact same spot. Why? Because we had to? No, because that felt normal. A really important thing to understand is that all human beings want to feel like things are normal. And so I had an experience once where I was working with a child, and he was an 11-year-old boy, and he had experienced terrible, terrible things in his home growing up. And he had experienced just unspeakable things. And he wasn't in that home anymore, and he was actually being brought to some place that was safe for him. And he was very excited about going to this facility that was going to be safe for him. But when I talked to him, he said, I've been wanting to get to this place for a long time. This is the second best thing that ever could have happened to me. When I asked him, well, what would be the best thing that could happen to you? And he said, well, if I could have gone back to that home. And he was meaning that home where he was horrifically abused. Well, that is not so abnormal from all of us. We all want to feel like things are normal. And so what we do is we tend to develop ways to make our lives seem, even things that are unhealthy, to make them feel normal. And so family homeostasis, as we go to the next slide, it's the natural tendency of families to behave in such a manner so that they can maintain a sense of balance, structure, and stability in the face of change. So we go back to Jack and Jane. After all those problems, why would Jane come to Jack and say, here, just have a drink? Though that story is obviously, being very general with it, I've seen it again and again and again in real life. And the reason is because in order to not go crazy, to feel like there was some sense of balance, some sense of structure, some sense of stability, during the time when Jack was alcoholic and drinking, and Jane made her job, in essence, made her function as the person who cleans up after everything, that became her norm. So when Jack stopped drinking, when Jane didn't have to clean up after him anymore, she felt weird. It felt out of place. It felt like it lacked homeostasis. Same thing with the kids. Some of you may have seen things like this. Jack comes home and then he wants to be a dad because that's part of what sobriety helps him do. But he hasn't been very present, so the kids have learned that they have to manage themselves. And so Jack begins to be a dad and try to help manage the kids, and they say no. They reject it because that's weird. It feels weird. So family homeostasis can be kind of an inertia, an energy that actually works against change in the system. Often we look at family systems that are unhealthy or seem dysfunctional, and we say things like, how can people continue to live like that? And this is why. Because it is a natural human tendency to want things to feel normal. One of the ways that we do this is by developing rules. Now, think about your family growing up. What were some of the rules in your family, and were they spoken rules, or were they unspoken rules? I grew up the son of military officers, and so I'll tell you that I was very clear that, you know, boys were not allowed to wear hats inside the house. That was a very much a known and spoken rule. You do not wear a hat inside the house. But I'm also the fourth of six children. And so I know this. There was an unspoken rule. If a younger kid is watching cartoons on Saturday morning and an older sibling wants to come in and watch wrestling, the older sibling is going to win. Now, that wasn't ever spoken. But it was an unspoken rule that I knew. On our next slide, we list some very important family rules that are understood in alcoholic families. The three most important are don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. Think about growing up in an alcoholic family or being part of an alcoholic family. even though we understand that addiction is a disease. And remember that when we say alcoholic, I mean any addicted family. Even though we know that addiction is a disease, there is still a lot of stigma that is associated with it. There's a lot of shame that's centered around it. And so it's very common to get this message. Don't talk about this outside of the family. Don't talk. Don't trust is something that we learn simply by the nature of our experience. How many times the kids might say, how many times did Dad say he would be there? And he wasn't. Or how many times have we seen dishonesty that has been used in order to protect us? Don't trust. It's something that we learn very early on when we grow up in addicted or alcoholic families. And finally, don't feel. This is something that the clinicians that will, they'll call it impaired mourning. In essence, it's not okay to have your own feelings. It's not okay to be sad. It's not okay to be angry about this. And when we learn that it's not okay to be sad and when it's not okay to be angry, and sometimes when it's not okay to feel anything in our homes, we tend to carry this out in life. How often do we ourselves, or how often do we know people who, if they describe any feeling, if they talk about feelings, they always apologize for their feelings. There might be someone listening to this that relates, that says, I always feel like I have to apologize for my feelings. Growing up in alcoholic or addicted families, these are three very clear, very important rules, and they're all revolved around keeping the homeostasis, holding things together. So what happens when people grow up in that type of family? On the next slide, there's a number of different things that happens. People grow up trying to guess at what normal behavior is. They're not sure what's healthy and what's unhealthy. They tend to have difficulty in following through a project from beginning to end. It's not uncommon when people grow up in these family systems that they lie when it would be just as easy to tell the truth. And that's not because they have some moral degradation. It's because they have that grew up with those family rules. People who grow up in these homes tend to judge themselves harshly, without mercy. Sometimes they have difficulty having fun, and they take themselves very seriously all the time. When you grow up in that kind of home, in that type of environment, everything is serious all the time. Often, people who grow up in alcoholic families have a hard time with intimate relationships. They overreact to changes that they have no control over. They're constantly seeking approval or affirmation. They usually feel like they're different from other people. It's interesting, as I talk to people over the years again and again and again, that's one thing that I see pretty much common is no matter how much I love people or care about people or I have friends that I'm close to, I'm always just a little bit on the outside. People who grow up in these family systems tend to be either super responsible or super irresponsible, one extreme or the other. They tend to be extremely loyal, and even when that's really unhealthy, they tend to stay in circumstances that are very unhealthy for them out of a sense of loyalty. And I think we can just look at how we've talked about how the system is growing up and kind of understand a little bit better why they would. People who grow up in these systems also tend to be very impulsive and don't think a lot about the consequences. Or they tend to be the opposite. They tend to be locked up in decision-making and think about nothing but the consequences. hopefully at this point what we're beginning to see is that addiction in a family system affects every member of the family, and it affects them long term. But also that it is impossible to have healing from addiction inside if a whole family doesn't get healing. All of the parts need help. One of the things that we see happen is that oftentimes in these systems, in order to develop homeostasis, to feel like things are normal, family roles will develop. On the next slide, we list some of those family roles. And I say this, that this is just one way of understanding how families work, but this is one of my personal favorites because I see this again and again. So often in family systems where there is alcoholism, drug addiction, what we see is that people take certain roles. For example, the enabler. The enabler would be Jane in our Jack and Jane situation. She's that person that constantly goes behind and cleans up after the addicted person, that cleans up after the addiction, and unwittingly makes the addiction possible to continue. Often in these families, there will be a hero. And often the hero is one of the kids, especially in family systems where there are children. It's not uncommon for one to become the perfectionist, to become the hero child, that straight-A student, that perfect in everything they do. Because what underlies their belief is that if they are less than perfect, that the family, that the whole system, that the whole world will fall apart. In these systems, there's almost always a scapegoat. The scapegoat is the person who is seen as being the cause of all the problems. In Jack and Jane's family, Jack would be the scapegoat. He's the identified person as this is where all of our family problems stem from. Well, you can see a lot of problems in that, especially because of the fact that we've learned that it's never just one person. Our problems in families, they stem from the whole family. All of us are affected by it, and so all of us need help. When we have a scapegoat that is the identified problem, well, then that's the only place that attention is going to be placed. There's often a mascot. And that mascot is the person, especially if there's a lot of kids, you'll see a mascot. And that's that person who just kind of makes everything okay by laughing stuff off, by telling everybody it's not a big deal. They're generally very well liked. They're very gregarious. They're very funny. But underneath, they have the same type of pressure that that hero child has. They think, if I don't break the tension will destroy us. It's all on me. And finally, we'll often find that in family systems where there is addiction, there's a tendency to be a lost child. People fall through the cracks. Our kids, our loved ones, they fall through the cracks because we're spending so much time, effort, and energy into dealing with the symptoms. But what happens is we get into our roles, and we tend to get comfortable in them, even if we hate them, we might get comfortable in them until a crisis occurs. The crisis is the event or the series of events that happens when the family system is shaken, and the truth of how unhealthy they are, how the progression of the disease, how the disease has progressed, is realized. And the family often says, how did we get here? generally, when people get there, their first step is to say, we just need to find help for the patient. We just need to get Jack help. And then what happens is, once they get Jack help and Jack gets into treatment, everybody else at first feels relief, like, the problem is solved. And they stop asking the question, how did we get here? This is when it is imperative for families to dive in to help themselves and to recognize that the person who is the alcoholic or the addict is not the only one who has progressed in the problem, but the whole family has. And they deserve help and understanding just as much as the addicted person. Unfortunately, a lot of times we believe some myths about treatment. We think that once the alcoholic or addict, agrees to go into treatment, the problem's all over, they'll never drink or use again. And then when they come home, things will be perfect. They'll be just the way they used to be. The crisis is over, and if they get help, the whole family will be fine. Unfortunately, as I hope we've learned today, that myth is just that, a myth. Alcoholism and drug addiction, this is a disease of the brain that is treatable, but it requires serious hard work, intervention, and long-term work on the part of both the addicted person and the family members. The whole system must get well. The next slide notes 7 C's for families, and it's imperative for us to begin to consider these. If you're a family member and you're concerned with the chemical dependency of a loved one, you have to know this. You didn't cause it. You cannot cure it, and you cannot control it. What you can do is you can help take care of yourself by communicating your feelings, by making healthy choices, and by celebrating being yourself. And how do you do that? How do you communicate your feelings and make healthy choices? If you're a person who's a family member that relates to this, there is help. There are resources for you. I encourage you to seek out counseling yourself. But also to know that just like there is AA and NA for the addicted person, there are groups like Al-Anon and Alateen and NACOA, and that's the National Association for Children of Alcoholics. There are groups for those of you that are family members that can help you get your healing as well. I encourage you, you are worth it. You deserve it. And if we're going to defeat addiction, it must be done in the context of the entire family. I hope all of this makes sense, and I look forward to your questions. And I'm going to turn it over to James now.
Thank you, Mr. Diamond. To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in the survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. Please tell us the degree to which you agree or disagree with the following statements. Question 1. This session educated me about the effects of addiction on the family. Press star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, or star 4 for strongly disagree. Question 2. This session provided me with information about the importance of including the family in treatment of addiction. Press star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, or star 4 for strongly disagree. next question. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, or star 4 for strongly disagree. Question 4. I would recommend this program to others. Press star 1 if you agree, or star 2 if you do not agree. For our final survey question, please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with substance abuse issues. Press star 1, I am a person with a substance abuse issue. Star 2, I'm a family member of someone with a substance abuse issue. Star 3, I'm a treatment provider for someone with a substance abuse issue. Or star 4 for other. Thank you for your feedback and for participating in our program. If you would like to make any additional comments to help us improve this program or have any questions on today's topic, press star 1 to have your line opened into the conference. Once again, press star 1 if you have a question or comment. And we do have a question.
Hi, I was wondering if the next time, as far as the family dynamics, you could maybe relate it to the parent's role in the family dynamics of the parent of a substance abuse person.
You bet. I mean, I'd certainly like to talk about that at length. And my experience is the dynamics tend to be very much the same, that as parents, we can tend to, especially in the idea of, you know, as parents, we want to do what? We want to protect our children. That's pretty normal. And so one of the things that we'll see is we as parents can become enablers, just like that Jane character, with the best intentions. And so our kids will begin to get in trouble, you know, maybe at school or other things. And our heart is to protect them, and by protecting them rather than aggressively addressing the chemical use, we sometimes can actually become enablers. So I definitely think that from an emotional perspective, it's a bit of a different dynamic, but functionally I think the dynamics are very much the same. But I would love to do a talk just about parents one of these days.
Yeah, the 7 C's is great.
Mm-hmm.
That's already going on my door.
Okay.
Thank you.
So you know that. You're welcome. Thank you very much.
And at this time, oh, actually, we do have a question. Caller, please go ahead. If you're using a speakerphone, to press your mute function or pick up your handset.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I am the stepmother of 2 heroin addicts. And when you talk about healing the family, obviously we have a bit of a complication, I guess, in that my husband's ex-wife, and she admits it herself, is an enabler. How do we go about, and yet I would consider her part of the family unit, and how do we go about healing as a whole family when the part of the family is divided,
yeah,
or separated, you know, by virtue of a divorce?
That is a fantastic question, and it's a common thing. I mean, we see that a lot. First of all, let me say that, as you already know, this is not going to shock you, there are no simple answers to that question. That dynamic becomes very, very difficult. But there's a principle. I go back to those seven C's. I go back to that idea and that principle that says everyone in the system needs help. And with each person, not just with the addicted person, I can't cure or control any individual in the system, their pathology, so to speak, their problem, their enabling, their scapegoating, whatever it is. And so when I have a system where obviously I'm trying to, and it sounds like, you know, you're trying to facilitate or comfortable with or looking for a system where there's healthy communication. And the first thing I would say is, if you can have healthy communication in that family system, which can be sometimes difficult with blended families, but if you can, that can often go a long way. And getting the whole family system on the same, so for example, here we do a family program, and we'll often bring everybody here and encourage everyone, so all the steps and all the in-laws, to be part of the process. But I know that that's not always possible. When it is, I still apply those seven C's to my behavior, my choices. So sometimes, when you can, making everybody a part of the therapeutic process is incredibly helpful. A lot of times, it's impossible. And when that happens, if I have it, and sometimes even, I'll see often parents will be in different places. Even parents living in the same home, you know, dad will say, I got to keep protecting them, and mom will say, it's time to let them feel the consequences. And so what do you do there? In those cases, A, seek professional help, and if it's possible, do it all together. But B, I'd encourage each one of them to continue to focus on their own well-being so that they practice those principles out, those seven C's out.
Would you suggest that as a group therapy type situation?
If you have access to someone, like if you were here, absolutely. There are other, you know, Hanley has these, there are other centers that have family programs like this, and sometimes you'll find, and depending on where you live, there are marriage and family therapists and addictions professionals who will work with whole families. So if I was working with your family and you said, you know what, I'm stepmom and we're not on the same page with mom, and this conflict is making the problem worse, absolutely, I'd say let's all come together and begin working on it.
Okay, and does that include the addict in the meeting as well?
Both. First of all, I absolutely yes.
Okay.
I would, you know, and for us, we would have probably meetings with individuals, meetings with families, but sometimes meeting with everybody together.
Okay. Okay, that's very helpful guidance. Thank you. And I wanted to state that my husband and I recently started attending Nar-Anon, even though this has been an ongoing problem in our life for 10 years, and I can't tell you the difference it has made. So anybody else that's out there, strongly encourage you to attend a meeting in your area.
Thank you so much for that. That if you can get one, you know, if you can help one person access that kind of help, it can be life-changing. Thank you so much for that.
At this time, there are no further questions.
Thank you so much for attending, and thank you, John, for speaking today. If you have additional questions for our speaker, please contact him through the Hanley Center listed on today's PowerPoint. If you have specific questions in regard to treatment or your policy, please contact the outpatient team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Our next seminar will be on May 21st. If you haven't already done so, feel free to listen to the replays of any of the past year's seminars and be sure to sign up to receive automatic email reminders for our upcoming sessions. Thank you.
That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.